Hello, my friends, and happy new year. Welcome back to PlayStation Blogcast. This is episode 275, and on today's show, we have an interview with the team behind Life is Strange Before the Storm. We are going to be talking with one of the senior producers behind Blood and Truth on PlayStation VR, and a lot of news you can use, a great listener letter. There's lots to go. I'm one of your hosts, Ryan Clements, joined by Justin Massengill.
I feel like you may have oversold the news you can use if you so choose segment.
There's holiday cards. There's Game of
the
Year
voting.
Hey,
whoa, don't spoil everything.
Okay, all right.
I only have like three things here. Don't go through all of it.
Justin, Happy New Year. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Kristen Titus, welcome back to the program.
Hello. I have no plans to disparage the news that we can use. I think it's great.
Yes, it is great, Justin. Believe in yourself.
Believe it.
So anyway, folks, thank you so much for joining us. This is the first show of 2018, and as you can probably guess by our banter about the news you can use, we're still getting started in 2018. Some of the team is not even back yet.
It is our first day back in the office.
From their holiday break, exactly. However, I want to throw this out there in advance. I had this amazing Life is Strange interview that was accidentally not used during the launch week of the game last year.
Sorry.
With that said, still a great interview. Loved talking to, make sure I get titles right. Chris Floyd was with Deck Nine, the developers, and then we actually talked to Ashley Birch as well. So all that is coming up.
I'm so jealous you got to talk to Ashley.
Me too.
It was a great interview, and both of them, you'll see. So stay tuned for that. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go to that news you can use if you so choose.
Oh,
sponsored
yeah.
by Justin Massengill
PlayStation
Blog.
I didn't agree to this. Yeah,
you
I'm not sponsoring anything, but yeah, so we had, while we weren't here in the office over the holiday break, we did have a lot of good stuff go out. We had let's kick things off with the Game of the Year talk. we're not quite ready to announce all of the winners of the reader-voted PlayStation Blog Game of the Year polls just yet.
I am, and the winner is...
Darkest Dungeon.
I am sifting through, panning for gold. I'm like sifting through looking for all the winners out of the... I think we had... Hold on, I actually got the exact number of votes. I think that this was our biggest year yet.
It was big. He told us earlier today, and we all collectively were like, ooh.
We had a cumulative total across all categories of 1,664,191 votes.
Now those potentially might not be unique people voting.
That's
votes.
All the votes across all categories.
Right. So okay. Someone might come in there and vote for a bunch of different things.
Yeah, but I think the most voted in category was best PS4 game, understandably
awesome.
So, and that Makes was sense. Around that was like 153,000 votes.
Awesome. That's so, great.
Yeah, yeah, huge turnout.
And
thank you all so
you,
much
yeah.
for voting. I'm really excited to publish the post with all the winners in it. Should be live before the next episode of PlayStation Blogcast goes live, so please look forward to it. Any guesses from you fine folks about feel
us?
Free to take a stab at any category.
Wait, us? Or,
yeah, from
oh.
you. Yeah.
Well, I kind of know. You've been telling me everything today. I can't
well,
guess
Well, play
anymore.
Dumb and pretend that I didn't tell you.
My
Come
guess.
Come on, Ryan.
Justin, the illusion is shattered. We cannot continue.
What do you think is the most anticipated PS4 game?
Oh, Tealu 2. Wait, was that on the list? I can't remember.
So The Last of Us 2 won last year, so it was
oh,
not
I see.
Eligible to
I
be
see.
Nominated this year.
I think maybe like God of War, I would say.
Yeah, that's
got to
be up there.
That.
Okay.
That's got to be
maybe
up there.
Maybe Dayton. I don't know.
Best soundtrack?
I would say Nier or Undertale.
I would say Nier or Undertale.
Or Persona 5.
Or
I loved
Persona
that sound. That's what I voted for, Persona
last
5.
Last year was maybe the best year ever for video game soundtracks.
I can't believe we're saying last year already in regards to 2017.
Crazy, right?
And
2017 was an interesting one. Let's just move on.
Uninteresting ones. That raves Justin Massengill.
Yeah, 2017 was something else. Yeah, great year for games though. Holy
oh
moly.
My gosh.
Best year since what, like 1998, I think.
That's you're pulling that one out there, but
1998
sure.
was a great year.
like a fine wine.
2017 holiday card post. We had this go out just after we all left for break. And this was a really fun one. We do this every year where we get holiday cards from our friends across the industry. They, you know, have the digital versions of these cards that they send out to their friends and media and stuff like that. So we collect all of those cards into a giant post. And I think that this was our biggest one yet, but I didn't bother counting, so I can't guarantee that. Feel free to go count for yourself if you care that much. But it's a great post. There are some really adorable cards in there. Even though the holidays may be behind us, it's still a fun little thing to go back and check out.
The holidays live on in our hearts.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be more holidays.
For a few
weeks. The next one? Valentine's. Let's do a Valentine's card, Valentine card post. That'd be fun, right?
I kind of love that with holiday cards, though. Like, I was in LA for vacation, and when I got back, there was like 10 Christmas cards waiting for me in my tiny little mailbox. It was hard to get the door open. So it's kind of a nice feeling of like,
yeah,
oh, there's still some holiday left. Mm-hmm.
It's that lingering holiday cheer. Move on.
Okay. I just felt that we should linger on that a little.
Ah, okay.
So our friends at PlayStation Europe, they actually put together an amazing series of blog posts that we ran on our site as well. Really cool series where they reached out to a bunch of developers and asked them what their favorite games of 2017 were, their favorite characters, their favorite moments from games, their favorite new mechanics, their most anticipated games for the upcoming year, stuff like that. And it really ended up being a great series. If you are looking for some reading material, head to the old PlayStation blog. We syndicated that on the U.S. PlayStation blog, but you can find them in their native habitat over at blog.eu.playstation.com. Some of the devs that they talked to, they got some heavy hitters here. They got Yoko Taro. They got some folks from Guerrilla, some folks from Square Enix, including Naoki Yoshida. They got some folks from CD Projekt Red, Arkane Studios, Team Ninja, Ubisoft, Media Molecule, all kinds of developers all up in there sharing their favorite games of 2017. So
that's great.
Excellent series. Highly recommend going and checking some of that out. Makes for some great bedtime reading.
Do you remember what Taro-san's favorite games of the year were off the top of your head?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay, I'll go look.
Sorry. Yeah, that's a nice little incentive to go check out the post. I'm not just going to tell you here. You got to go to the blog. You got to see for yourself.
I need you to list every game mentioned in that.
You
got
to go to PlayStation,
right?
A dot blog.
Read it to us verbatim.
Oh, yeah. I'll just read the entire story here. That'd make for
actually, just read
video.
All the blog posts on the show.
That's a good new content strategy for the blogcast. I feel like that'll
it's
fill
some minutes.
It's just
an audio. It's like an audio book of the PlayStation blog.
It's a text-to-speech reading. Of, as a matter of fact, we don't even need to do it. Just put it all into a software reader.
There you go.
Yeah. Last piece of news that you can choose to use if you so choose to do so. the PlayStation Plus games for January have been announced. They are Deus Ex Mankind Divided and Batman the Telltale Series. Two really good picks this month, I think. Deus Ex Mankind Divided, that came out not too long ago.
Yeah, that's excellent, too.
Yeah, and that was a great game. And Batman the Telltale Series. I only played the first episode of this, but I thought it was really good. Mm. I want to go back and play that some more because Telltale does some great stuff, some of the best storytellers out there. I still think that Tales from the Borderlands is one of the best episodic experiences I've seen. Special bonus for PlayStation VR owners. Starblood Arena is free for Plus members starting now until March 6th.
Ooh, there you go.
So get in there and grab that outer space arena shooter cool thing. It's a fun game.
And
yeah,
the are the other January games already available now?
Yeah, you can go download those games right now if you're a PlayStation Plus member.
Thank you, Justin. I cannot wait any longer. I must get to my Life is Strange interview, which we did before the holiday break. So again, apologies for the slight discrepancy in timing. With that said, I spoke to Chris Floyd and Ashley Birch about the then recently released Life is Strange Before the Storm episode 3, I want to say. Absolutely lovely interview. I'm so glad I get to share it with our audience right now. So enjoy. Hello, my friends, and welcome back. I have two special guests in studio today. I am joined by Chris Floyd, Deck Nine's co-game creator on Life is Strange Before the Storm. And also I have actor, writer, and because this is a PlayStation podcast, the voice of Aloy from Horizon Zero Dawn, Ashley Birch, joining us. Thank you both for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
of
thank you.
Of course. It's my pleasure. This is a treat for me. I was excited about this interview for a while, so I want to start with something for both of you, and you can do rock, paper, scissors on who starts. The Life is Strange franchise, both, you know, the original run and Before the Storm, seems to have garnered almost like an instant following and had really gathered a community together. And I'm wondering why you think that is and what about it kind of created this instant community. Who wants to start?
Should we rock, paper, scissors? No, you can go ahead.
Well, I think it's really down to the unique vision and the execution of that vision that Don't Nod had in the first season. I just think they did some really amazing work there, both visually and in how they drew their characters and the way they told their story. So that was, I just think, something that people didn't expect and was felt new and different and something you don't see very often in the video game landscape. And a lot of people were hungry for that.
Absolutely. Ashley, additional thoughts?
Yeah, I think that these are stories that you don't often get to see in video games, like Chris said. And I think it's a testament to the game and how effectively they were able to and honestly and organically convey those stories of these teenage girls. And also that, you know, I think this is a sort of thing that gamers wanted. And I think we kind of assume that maybe the only games that gamers want have to have like guns and zombies in them, and it's just not
and
the case.
Guys with shaved heads. It's pretty common. We'll look it up. So do you feel like that setting that you just alluded to with you know, following these two high school students' lives, I mean, is that what gave it a particular pull with a younger audience and maybe an audience that is experiencing those same life events outside of time control? You know, in
although
their daily
knows?
Lives.
We don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm none the wiser for time control. What do you think?
I think it was that the story was told so authentically and that the characters were so well developed. You know, the same premise could have gone, you know, kind of gone sideways in different hands, you know, but I think Don't Nod and now Deck Nine have treated this world and those characters with such care and consideration, and they feel really rich. And they also tackled subjects that I think were a little bit could be a little bit darker or a little bit harder, and I think they did it with a lot of sensitivity and understanding of the implications of those things. And so I think the result is that you have this really rich, nuanced exploration of the life of being a, you know, an American teen, and then also specifically a girl. And I think that because it was treated with such care and respect and authenticity, that people really felt seen by it.
Well, let me piggyback off of the authenticity note and posit to Chris, to you. I wanted to kind of talk to you about what it was like with Deck Nine coming in and working in something that was, you know, as you already said, originally started with Don't Nod in France. And you guys are now kind of able to come at it from a perspective of a studio that's based in the United States. It's telling a story about, you know, American kids. And I'm wondering how you preserved Don't Nod's vision, but also kind of brought your own authenticity, your own spin to the story in Before the Storm.
Yeah, I mean, really, every day, our primary concern was that we were living up to the original game, because we knew the fans out there were really passionate about it, and they cared, and they wanted to see those same characters and some new characters that felt true to that spirit. Other than that, you know, our writers just you know, tried to be as honest and sincere as Ashley was describing, as honest and sincere with our characters and our story, as Don't Nod were with theirs.
I should have started with this, but let me give some background on Before the Storm. I mean, maybe Chris, you could tell me a little bit about the overall vision of what Before the Storm was trying to accomplish as a whole, and also give us an update on where the studio stands right now, because the bonus episode is not available yet, correct?
No, right. So so Before the Storm is a three-episode prequel to the original Life is Strange that Don't Nod created, and it takes the character of Chloe Price, who was sort of the main non-player character in the first game,
the original, right?
And makes her our protagonist, and you play as Chloe 3 years before the events of the first game, and you get to see the blossoming of a relationship that you heard about in that first game between Chloe and Rachel Amber. And so it's a three episode series, as I said. First two episodes are out. The third one is coming out next week.
Look at that timing. It's like you guys came here for a purpose.
Funny how that happens.
Yeah. Ashley, let me turn to you. What have you brought from role to role in your career as an actor specifically? And, you know, how do you feel like you've grown, and how does that growth influence your performance from role to role?
I think the thing that I try to always be conscious of when I'm approaching a role is being as honest and as vulnerable as I can be. I think that, you know, in the case of Chloe and the original Life is Strange, and then, of course, Aloy and Horizon, they're both really complex characters that have gone through a number of, frankly, traumatic things. And they're extremely human. And so I think to portray those characters honestly requires me to investigate those things in myself, the ways that we're connected. And also, you know, I'm not a method actor, so I don't feel like I become Chloe or become Aloy. But I think that...
Not yet.
I mean, if robot dinosaurs show up, who knows? Mm. But I always try to approach characters through empathy. So I don't feel like I necessarily become them, but I, through understanding them and relating to them, I feel for them. So, like, for example, in the infamous junkyard scene in the original Life is Strange, and I've told this story before, but Hannah Tell, who plays Max, and I were genuinely crying in the booth. And for me, you know, part of that was obviously portraying Chloe in the scene, but also I'd come to care about Chloe so much that my heart was breaking for her in that moment. So I think empathy is definitely a big part of it. And I forgot the second part of your question. What have I learned, I think, right?
Apparently I forgot also.
what have I learned, I think? I have, the more that I voice act, it feels sort of silly, but I still speak very quickly, but I go slower. And I think I go slower in terms of how I absorb scenes, literally how I speak. I think when I was younger, I would kind of, I would just want to give whatever I needed to give quickly, and there'd be like kind of a nervous energy. But I think as I grow a little bit more comfortable, I find that, you know, I am also searching more for collaboration. So I'm more vocal about thoughts that I have, and I really relish back and forths and more direct collaborations with developers and directors, just because I think that's important. And if you're not treating it as a true collaboration, then I think that there are things that, you know, both sides are going to miss from the performance. So I definitely take things slower. I ask more questions. I vocalize myself more, and I think ultimately we end up getting richer products out of the deal.
Out of the deal. The deal of emotion. Chris, before I return to you, I do want to follow up on one thing, Ashley, you mentioned, which is the vulnerability that comes mm-hmm. through playing, you know, your playing characters. And I think one thing that gamers and just an audience in general doesn't think about is when we watch something or play something, we laugh, we cry, we experience these emotions. You have to imagine that the person that's giving that performance and inhabiting the role in that moment is feeling that, you know, 5-10-fold. I'm not going to put a number on it, but how do you as an individual then also, I mean, is that putting an emotional strain and a drain on you because you are stepping into, as you say, traumatic situations that you have to embody for a moment and then you have to step away? But, you know, do you find that that's influencing and impacting your emotional balance on, you know, and in personal as well, personal life?
I find that, you know, sometimes it can be like, I think it's an interesting part of being an actor that, you know, emotional self-care is actually like part of, you know, in the same way that if you're a runner, you have to stretch.
Yeah, exactly.
Or, you know, it's an interesting and sort of strange aspect of being an actor. I'll also say that it can be very healing. Playing Chloe in particular, like I've lost people in my life, you know, just like she has. And, people that were too young to go and that kind of thing. And so there was, you know, in certain scenes, it was kind of like as Chloe was working through her grief, I was working through my grief. And so there is something that can also be really cathartic about those moments. But yeah, you also have to be aware of like taking care of yourself. And yeah. I definitely like didn't go out to like a party and like hung out with a bunch of people after my Life is Strange sessions. I went home, had a cup of tea, you know.
just have to decompress. Yeah, totally. A bit. Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And Chris, then speaking of, you know, catharsis and emotional resonance that Ashley is describing, how does your studio balance the need to create a, you know, narrative fabric, but also take into account the fact that this is interactive and you have a player that's also engaging with this and changing the pacing and changing the setting in which they are seeing these specific scenes? I mean, how do you guys take that into account when you're designing?
Yeah, you're right. It's one of the great challenges, I think, that we have. Sometimes narrative, especially really emotional, dramatic moments, can kind of strain against interactivity and gameplay. Sometimes it's hard to have both. But we look for sort of special moments to embody the emotions of the characters in gameplay. So, you know, we have a moment, our own in the junkyard in Before the Storm, where Chloe's furious with a baseball bat smashing things, but we let the player take control there, and everything she looks at has four verbs on it saying smash, 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 smash on it. And we thought that sort of showed through the interface of the game, where she's normally trying to be very neutral, kind of displayed her emotions for the player to kind of now take them on board. And I think made for a pretty effective moment. So that's one example.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing about game design in general, is that UI is something that you don't have in books or film, right, or pretty much any other medium. And UI can often be like the total underdog of conveying a piece of story or a moment, as you say, like having smash on all the right, corners of the screen. I mean, are there other moments where you feel like you play with the things that are specific to video games to tell your story?
Well, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, our game is so much about choice and consequence, and we look to make those choices as interesting as we can, and as agonizing, frankly, as we can. And that can come down to some very precise tricks of wording and how we choose to present you with when it comes to those choices. We'll sometimes fiddle with the individual little words just to make sure we're kind of tilting or biasing the player one way or another, or counteracting some bias we think they might be coming into, so we can make that decision just as difficult as possible, essentially.
Cruel and devious.
Basically.
Plotting in the background. Ashley, I was wondering how your experience with writing and narrative, you know, plays or informs your acting as well. Do you find that there's a lot of learning from both sides that you take into the field? Or
absolutely, yeah. I mean, I do find that I care a lot about character psychology, obviously, being an actor, but that informs my writing tremendously, and then can also make me annoying in the booth. I'm like, you know, potentially like, would this happen in this moment, or would this character do this? I mean, that's something that actors, you know, do and should do
of
anyway.
Course.
But
the writers are all like, "Oh God, what have we done?"
But it's, you know, I'm very, very conscious of it, and I actually had a really cool experience on the Frozen Wilds DLC, in that we were able to, before going into mocap and voice record, have conversations about Aloy's relationship to the new characters in this DLC, and a lot of discussion specifically about how she will interact with Aurea, who is one of the major new characters in the DLC. And I had a lot of back and forth with Ben McCall, who's the head writer of the DLC, and you know, how would Aloy treat this person who's extremely spiritual, because Aloy is pretty skeptical of that, but she's also very curious and a genuinely compassionate person. And so I think those kinds of conversations are definitely informed by my writing. And I think also it helps because I hopefully I like fear devs being like, but I try to, I'm very conscious that there is a story and a game that is much larger than just my part of it when I'm performing. So, and I'm also conscious of like the experience, because I game as well, the experience of the player. And so I never try to like push back on things or ask questions because I'm like afraid of how the performance is going to sound or whatever, but just consciously like, does this connect? I know that the goal of the scene is this, and that if it goes well, if it's executed correctly, that the player will ideally feel this. So how is my performance in that, the piece of that puzzle, how is it, you know, elevating it or, you know, delivering on the promises of the scene? And so it makes me more aware of the sort of lattice work of the game as a whole.
Hmm. Well said. And Chris, I'll kind of finish this first round of questions with you.
Round one.
That's maybe the furthest from the style of Life is Strange as possible. I mean, Life is Strange and Before the Storm are all about details, both in the world and the characters. I was just curious to know how your team and the artists and the designers, I mean, how a lot of those little tiny pieces came together and how those influenced the larger work.
Yeah, you're right. Environmental storytelling is as important as the storytelling we're doing with the characters, especially it rewards players who want to kind of dig deeper. Mm. So we kind of go in layers and stages through our scenes. You know, the script gets written and it'll include all the things that the character needs to look at, especially the stuff that's critical for getting through that scene, if there's a puzzle or important characters you have to talk to. But then both the writers and our level designers and environment artists will be thinking about the space, thinking about the characters who live in that space, and also just the balance of objects around the scene to make sure it feels like it's full and not over full, and come up with what are the additional little interactive objects that you'll be able to find, and what can they say about the characters. And that's the biggest thing for us is, whenever possible, to make sure they really feel relevant and kind of reveal just a little something new that you didn't know before you looked at that object.
What would, for both of you, and again, rock, paper, scissors for order, what it for both of you is the greatest challenge working in the world of Life is Strange, and how did you approach and hopefully overcome that challenge?
You know, for us, I think it was just that what Don't Nod had created was so special that we just knew there was a lot of pressure to live up to it. So, you know, as I say, we ask ourselves every day, are we being true to Life is Strange? Are we being true to these characters? Is this the Chloe everybody knows and loves? Are we bringing something new but still remaining honest to what everyone's expecting and what they love about that character? And that was vigilance every day and thinking very carefully about what we were doing as we went through that process. And we're just really delighted that the fans, it seems like, feel like we managed to hit that mark.
Ashley?
When I realized in the original series that we were heading toward this big choice at the end of the first season, and that your the degree to which you connected to Chloe is the determining factor for what choice you make, you know, that's... arguably, it's a lot of responsibility on the writing and on the performance to make that a difficult choice for players. And, you know, and I know this that you guys had this too, that you kind of want all the choices to feel like 50-50. You want to feel like every choice that the player has to make is a difficult one.
Unless
it's smash on all of them.
No choice.
On the UI. But yeah, so, you know, I wasn't thinking about that super, super consciously going in, because the most important thing is creating an authentic experience. But, yeah, I just really wanted to feel like I was being authentic and true to the character that Chloe is. And I was also conscious of not wanting to make her to maintain the idea that even though she can be aggressive and sassy and mischievous and can kind of maybe drag Max around a little bit into adventures that she might not necessarily want to go into.
Nonsense.
You know, that fundamentally she's motivated by a lot of pain and a lot of fear, and for that to be felt and to treat that with care.
Let's go a little more free form at the end of our discussion, our conversation here. We often spend some time talking about things that are not related to video games on this show. So for both of you, what is something that you've read, watched, played, listened to recently that you feel has had a big impact on you? It's totally open-ended. There are no wrong answers. Who wants to go?
I actually, so I, when I was younger, I got through the Harry Potters up through Order of the Phoenix, and then I stopped. So I actually, so but this year I went through and I listened to all the audiobooks, and then I watched all the movies. Whoa. So I had a very Harry Potter
year.
In one day.
we've had a similar year then, because my daughter got into Harry Potter this year and has been watching the movies nonstop, and so I've been picking them up along with her, and I'd never read any of them actually. Just
They're pretty remarkable.
Who does the audiobooks, may I ask?
Jim Dale, who is so fantastic. If you are into audiobooks, if you love Harry Potter, I'll say that I think he portrays some of the characters better than the actors in the movie, to be honest.
Hey, watch out. Controversial
I know,
statement.
Very controversial. I won't say who because I feel like a mob will go after me. I know. But yeah, he's fantastic. And The Deathly Hallows right now especially is an interesting reread, given like what's happened this year. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed them. They're just also like, it's so cool to see a franchise develop over the course, and you know, grow with its audience. So you're literally tackling new subjects and new, plunging new emotional depths every book. And I can't imagine, I have no idea how J.K. Rowling did it.
Yeah, I think about that all the time. How did she do this?
Yeah, it's remarkable.
I think she started on a typewriter or something too.
Did she
or
really?
Some old computer. I remember her saying in an interview that like the most humble beginnings you could possibly imagine, even in the tools that she was using to write. So the first draft. Chris, what else is in your docket right now that you can share with our audience?
Yeah, well, you know, earlier this year was the last season of a show called Halt and Catch Fire that I think a lot of people maybe haven't watched.
I heard it's great.
It's really good. I think it's AMC. And it's really kind of a slow burn, dramatic show about the beginnings of the tech industry. First season, it's the characters building the first, like, or one of the first IBM PC clones, and trying to get into that market. And it's got these characters that kind of feel like they're half archetypes, you know. One maybe has a little bit of a Steve Jobs kind of a feel to them. One's your kind of nerdy engineer, but they get really deep into their lives in a very low key way, but a really believable way. And one of the things I took away from it is how much just the dialogue of a scene and of a show, if they really paint the character well. It doesn't need to have necessarily tons of, you know, bells and whistles and fireworks exactly, and they have their moments, but it just propels this show along and really gets you into these characters because they feel extremely believable. It's a really great show.
Excellent. Good recommendations. Thank you both. My guests today again were Chris Floyd, the co-game director from Deck Nine, and also Ashley Birch, actor, writer, voice of Aloy. So third time. Sorry about most of the mentions were from Ashley, by the way. thank you both so much for joining me today. And then Life is Strange Before the Storm, is it safe to say, is coming to a conclusion in the near future?
Yeah, so the third episode is out December 19th, 20th, depending on where you are in the world when it launches. And then beginning of next year, we'll announce later the exact date, but we have the bonus farewell episode with Ashley voicing young Chloe Price again.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thanks
for having us.
Once again, my thanks to Chris and Ashley for an excellent conversation. Absolutely loved having them here in the studio. Hope everyone enjoyed listening at home or in the car, wherever you decide to listen to your podcast.
I'm listening to the podcast right now while we're recording the podcast. This is really weird.
ladies and gentlemen, I got an excellent, excellent listener letter in the emails from Andrew, which Chris and
That's
I would like
blogcast.sony.com.
blogcast@sony.com. Thank you, Justin. And this one is great. It will kick off 2018 as our first listener letter of the year and only listener letter for the rest of the year. We shall receive no more.
Oh, my gosh.
Kristen, why don't you take this one from Andrew?
Yeah, for sure. So Andrew writes in, hey, blogcast crew, and happy new year to you all. 2017 was pretty rad, not going to lie. Look at what we got. Awesome PlayStation games, new blogcasters, shout out to Zach and me, Kristen. Guinness World Record set for most darkest dungeon mentions in an ongoing series, I tease. He's totally right, though. Incredible year. What more could a blogcast listener ask for? However, 2018 is upon us now, and that means new beginnings. I'm curious to hear of new beginnings that had an impact on you in games, and by that I mean opening sequences, levels, or cinematics that made an impression or stuck with you all through the game. For me, Firewatch's tone-setting start was powerful and perfectly complemented by the stellar cast performances. Mm. Plus, I gotta mention the incredibly produced opening sequences of Tales of the Borderlands, which are on par with any top-tier TV show. Looking forward to hearing your own answers. Cheers and best wishes for 2018, Andrew. It's funny, you were just mentioning Tales of the Borderlands earlier.
Yeah, and that is spot on. That's such a perfect answer to that question. I don't know if I can do better than that. Tales from the Borderlands, man, those openings. I mean, they're on YouTube, but don't go watch them before you play the game because some of them are a little spoilery.
Yeah, and they're so much better once you've met the characters. I think, I want to say it was episode 4 from that series. It was like they're about to head to a ship, and it was like a slow-mo walk down a tarmac.
Yeah.
And it was just perfect because each of the characters sort of, it was just the best.
Yeah.
I got to get to that one. Maybe that's my next game. Who knows?
Tales from the Borderlands. So, like, whether you like Borderlands or not, I had I went through a phase with Borderlands where I was really into the first game, and then I was really into Borderlands 2 for a long time when it came out. And then I kind of just, like, got over it, and I was like, yeah, okay, I'm done with Borderlands now. And I thought I was out. But then Telltale made this series, and I played it, and it pulled me right back into that universe.
Yeah.
Like I thought I didn't really like, I was like, yeah, Borderlands, that was fun back in the day. But man, I think that Tales from the Borderlands is the best story that has been told in that universe.
I agree. I also really loved Borderlands, the first one. And I started the second one. I was enjoying it, but I was sort of like, I'm good on this content.
Yeah.
So I didn't even finish that game. I was like, I'm all right. And then when this came out, I love everything that Telltale has put out so far. So I was like, I trust them. Let's do it. And I'm so glad I did. It's definitely my favorite Borderlands-related thing at all. The voice acting is amazing. The characters are just hilarious.
It's got some of the funniest moments in video games, period.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, that's a good intro. So, but other than Andrew's example, what are some that you guys would say?
And I want to thank Andrew, by the way, because I thought this was such a great question. Because pulling the camera back a little bit, I will say that in my mind, and I think in a lot of minds, the beginning of a piece of art, a film, a video game, a story, is so vital to everything else. Mm. That is literally how you capture your audience. That's how you keep your audience. And I love this question because I love openings. It's one of my favorite parts of like films and video games is what is the thing, the most important thing that creator is showing you right at the beginning. And I was trying to mull it over because there's so many great video game openings over the years, or new beginnings, as Andrew says. I will say that I think The Last of Us should be called out, even though it's a common answer. I think that the entire opening section of that game is probably one of the best.
That's a good one.
Strongest narrative openings in a game.
I actually think Final Fantasy VII is a great example of this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Incredible opening to that game. No matter how many times I see or play the opening to Final Fantasy VII, I still get goosebumps.
And Kristen is going to experience it for the first time.
My update is over the holidays, I purchased and downloaded Final Fantasy VII. So haven't started it yet, but I'm excited to see what the opening is.
I cannot wait to talk to you about this. I love that you're going to experience it for the first time.
Yeah,
this is exciting.
How often does someone get to really live through a legendary first-time experience like that? It's exciting.
Yep. Speaking of which,
yeah,
Nier Automata had a great opening too.
Yeah, that one was really good too.
That one is more just like less like impactful and momentous, and more just like, we're throwing everything at the wall.
Yep.
And it all works. Like they throw everything at the wall and it all sticks. Just it seamlessly goes from like top down bullet hell shooter to side scrolling platformer and back and all kinds of crazy stuff in the first like 15 minutes of the game.
The original Bayonetta opening is phenomenal. If I'm remembering correctly, have you never played Bayonetta?
No. I'm a bad person.
Lasers. If I'm remembering correctly, I forgot if there's maybe a little prologue or a foreword in the game at some point. A foreword. Like, it's written by Stephen King. I believe it starts with Bayonetta literally fighting a bunch of angels on falling debris from a giant chapel that was just blown up.
Sweet.
It's great. Platinum Games has always been spectacular at those just outrageous and over the top opening set pieces.
I'm just thinking about like my favorite games now, and they all have pretty great open. Portal 2 has an incredible opening.
That's true. I think most recently the one that's impacted me the most was the beginning of Horizon Zero Dawn. Like I thought it was a really seamless intro, and like him just raising little baby Aloy and like shouting out her name, I was like, the dad feels.
Yeah. you could probably start crying right there.
No, I genuinely
you haven't even
like,
pressed start yet.
It's like the first 5 minutes of the game, and I genuinely like turned to my fiance and was like, I'm gonna love this game. It was so good. And then another moment, I kind of love game, like those intro moments where then it incorporates the logo like right after.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, one of the first ones I think of is the intro to Assassin's Creed 2, that your character Ezio is, he was just like sleeping with some girl and had to run away. And then he runs into his brother and the two of them decide to like have a race with each other. And they climb to the top of this clock tower, and it's like the first like Eagle Vision type moment. And it's sort of just the two of them being like brothers, like, oh, we're amazing. And then it's like Assassin's Creed 2 and the music swells. Nice. And it's like this glorious view of Italy, and
Kristen bursts into tears.
I mean, it was a great moment. And like, you really see how much he loves his family, which then shows the tragedy that is soon to befall him.
I never played.
Spoilers on the, 8-year-old game? Yeah,
which I haven't played Assassin's Creed 2, but I've heard it's one of the best ones.
It is absolutely, I would say, top three, if not number one.
The entire God of War series for strong openings.
Great openings.
Especially 3, I think. Just like fighting Poseidon, like trying to climb up Mount Olympus.
That's true.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. I think in terms of levels, the entire opening to Oblivion, I would say, Elder Scrolls Oblivion. It's like you get the Patrick Stewart like narration at the beginning of him playing Uriel Septim, and then you're trying to get out of this like dungeon prison of the castle, and you run into him, and he's just like, yeah, I'm cool with you being here. Like, help me escape from this assassination attempt. But it was one of the first video games that like really got me into role-playing games, and I was just like, this is such a cool introduction. So yeah,
I'm sure there's so much that we're
so many
over here.
You know, the opening is first for a lot of games, especially games that follow a slightly more traditional cinematic approach. That is the closest that the video game blends itself with cinema, and you get like, you know, you get to enjoy all the beauties of cinematic storytelling and, you know, camera work and music and voiceover all working in tandem, and I love it. I want to think more on this question, and maybe we'll even come back to it again in the weeks to come.
I think we should get some user suggestions.
Perfect.
Too.
Thank you, Justin. You're pouncing on the listener letters. So, what is your favorite opening or new beginning to a video game, and maybe to like a movie too? But let's start with video games. Please do send us your suggestions and your entries to blogcast@sony.com. I would love to hear them. I think we would all love to hear them. And thank you again to Andrew for a great question.
Yeah,
and
that's
Happy
really
New Year.
Great conversation starter. Great way to kick off 2018, I think. Ryan, you had another interview, I think.
I do. So I also, this was, I believe, recorded during PlayStation Experience, and we had to, again, keep this on hold until after the holiday. But this, I had the great fortune of talking to James Oates, a senior producer at SIE London Studio, about Blood and Truth. Another great conversation, and I hope all of you enjoy. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, let us please welcome James from London Studio. He is the senior producer on Blood and Truth, which is coming exclusively to PlayStation VR. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for making time in a busy day. And we have to keep it tragically quick, but I wanted to get a bit of an update on Blood and Truth, which was revealed a little earlier, not too earlier this year, from at Paris Games Week in Paris.
Yep.
Which almost seems like the perfect setting to reveal. I know it's set in the gritty London underground, but it's still, you know, it's got, you had your European flair. You were able to have a great showing and, yeah, kind of showcase what is a gorgeous, super high octane crime thriller, I guess. Yeah. That's my takeaway from it.
Thank you very
but
much.
But did I encapsulate it well?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, what we're doing with Blood and Truth, I mean, it's if people are familiar with VR Worlds, it's a title that borrows a lot from the London Heist, but is very much its own, it's its own beast. Basically, what we're gunning for is to make a AAA action adventure game for VR that's built from the ground up for VR. And with this title, we're really pushing to make something that is, whereas London Heist is very much about gangsters and cockneys, this is more about making something that is in the vein of a true modern action movie, like something like John Wick or Atomic Blonde. That's what we want to go for. We want to make you feel like you are an action hero.
Did you see Atomic Blonde?
I have not seen Atomic Blonde. I've seen John Wick.
Yeah, I love John Wick. I actually have been meaning, kind of want to see Atomic Blonde. Someone was just talking to me about it. So that sounds excellent. Now, is it safe to say, does Blood and Truth occupy the literal same universe as the London Heist, or are you not saying?
No, we are. No, this is very much its own story, its own, yeah. So it's set in modern London. It kind of embraces both the glamour and the grit of London. So you'll have seen in the demo, we're in this very kind of high end casino, but we also want to take the story to the London we know. So you know, there's a variety of locations, from rundown tower blocks to what you're seeing in the demo.
So what did the team learn from working on VR Worlds? Because I feel like there were a lot of lessons that you learned just naturally by making a big splash right out of the gate with VR. And now you're coming back with, I would say, a more focused experience that you're going further with. And what lessons are guiding you on that?
It's such a tough question because there is so much. Like, I mean, not just the lessons from that game, but lessons we learn every day. I mean, there is very much a kind of pioneer spirit about VR right now. We're continually finding new problems, but then new interesting solutions. I mean, I'd say, you know, some of the big stuff from VR Worlds that we're taking forwards are, you know, things around one-to-one interaction and how just like those little moments where you're picking up a cigar and smoking it in the London Heist, people respond to so much. They love that sequence. So it's not just about those big features like the traversal and the gunplay. It's also about the little things that kind of add to that experience and add to that level of immersion in a VR game.
That's one of the things that I often feel like goes unrepresented, or at least underrepresented, in video games, is quiet, small moments that give you perspective on the larger, more bombastic moments. And that's something I always advocate for, is you can't have the giant action set piece if you don't have, you know, the calm before the storm, right?
This is very true. Yeah, I mean, you sound like you've worked on the design team.
Surprise! Rip off my mask.
We're constantly looking at pacing and how you break up this experience, and kind of unlike a traditional game, we're kind of looking at this more like a movie. So you're looking at the pacing of each mission, you're making sure you've got those highs and lows, you're making sure you've got those moments of calm to then really emphasize the action scenes when they really happen. And also, just from a VR perspective, we've learned that if you break up the experience and you have those calmer moments and those longer action scenes, then you can make a longer playtime and a longer play session, and you don't tire the player. So we've gone from having 10-minute play sessions now to kind of 30, 40 minutes. We can have people playing much longer, much more interesting missions now by breaking it up.
Absolutely. What about the gameplay, can you tell me? Because this is a lot more wrinkles, it seems, than the London Heist. It feels like you have a little bit more of an impact on the world around you.
Sure, yeah. So we've got kind of our core pillars, the core things that we work around. We've obviously got the obvious stuff like the gunplay and the traversal and the movement around the environments, but we also heavily lean into the storytelling and the drama scenes as well. That really is what builds out this experience and makes it much more than just a standard shooter. And we're not really showing too much of that yet in the current demo, but in the future demos you're going to see, in the future missions, you're going to see a lot more of how we're taking cutscenes and drama to the next level in VR.
To the next level, even. Level two.
Yeah. Yeah. And beyond, hopefully, yeah.
I don't know if you're comfortable sharing, so, you know, let me know. But any particular challenges unique to VR that the team had to overcome? Because, you know, as we talk about a lot on the show, this is both a new and a familiar space for developers, and especially with the launch of PlayStation VR, sometimes this was developers' first foray into soiree. What's the word? What am I thinking of?
Go with what you like. Yeah, I'm not sure.
But what kind of challenges did you guys have to overcome?
That it's an interesting question, because again, there is so many things I could talk about. But I would say, I mean, one of the good ones, one of the interesting ones, is around. It's just around player feedback and how you, like, some of the simplest things you would do in a traditional game, like how much ammo do you have, how much health do you have, all of those things, you have to rethink for VR. You have to, because you don't want to have interface cluttering things up. You want to have a pure cinematic experience. You want to have the player be able to drink in the environment. So the way we're approaching that and some of the ideas we're going for are kind of around this concept of the military mind. So the character you play, Ryan Marks, is a soldier, and he's got lots of experience and training in that area. So what we've been able to do is then take that concept and apply it to the game. So you are, when you look at a scene, when you look at a combat environment, you are seeing the view from Ryan's mind's eye. So he will see a cover location, and he will, and that will ping up on his view, and you will see ammo in the environment. You're basically Jason Bourne-ing the arena and just seeing where all your exits are and where all your combat opportunities are.
You've just named so many of the most classic modern action movies, so I think you're getting people a little excited.
Yeah.
Is setting your game in London and the home of your studio and the employees, is that a help or a hindrance in trying to design a space that represents a place you're very familiar with?
It's a big plus for us, I think. I think it's one of those funny things where, you know, we're based in London, we're called London Studio, so we feel like we've got responsibility there to some extent. But then you also see other games kind of trying to do London, and you feel like, hey, you know, that's ours. We can do this properly. You know, that's the chocolate box version of London. It's always having Big Ben in the background and stuff like that. But we kind of want to do London right. And you know, it's interesting in like TV and drama, things like Luther and stuff like that being really popular. You've got London coming across as this new kind of character, and we want to kind of do that in games as well.
What do you think is the most important thing to convey to a player in virtual reality?
Wow. So I would say, I think doing what you can to really place you in the scene and keep you in the scene, keep you immersed. That's something we really focus on, because it's so easy to break that immersion, and that's the golden ticket. If you can put someone on being in that environment, being in that action movie moment, that's when the pulse goes, that's when the adrenaline goes, and that's where we want to keep you. So it's some of the stuff we talked about before, and some of the stuff we did in London High. So what we found with things like the van scene, if you're familiar with that, in there with Mickey, where you were driving along and you're kind of shooting people on the M25. What we found was actually by adding all of those little extra interactions in that scene, where you could tune the radio and play with the sun visor and things like that. That was actually the stuff that bedded you into that scene. So when the action kicks off, you are so much more immersed at that point. So it's you know, it's about selling you and tricking your brain to the point where you are there, and then you let the action flow.
James from London Studio, thank you so much for joining
thank
me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Blood and Truth, coming to PSVR exclusively in the future.
Yes.
And I look forward to hearing more, and safe travels and good luck with the rest of development.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My thanks again to James from London Studio for talking Blood and Truth, coming to PlayStation VR. And that was it for my interviews. All done. We want to talk about
some. Wait, where is it?
We want to talk about stuff.
What are you playing? Yeah. So what? Before we end the show today, we'll do a quick around the room about what we're playing, what we're watching. I know that there was some Black Mirror viewing happening in the team, but what about games? What's in the rotation right now, guys?
Well, I just recently finished playing Oxenfree for the first time. Did two playthroughs of it. Might do another one. It's a really kind of spooky game.
Give you reasons to do multiple playthroughs,
yes,
or do you just really want to?
Both.
How long is one playthrough, like roughly?
It's short, right?
It's pretty short, but it also depends on, there are some optional digging around and, you know, trying to solve what's happened on this island that these teenagers are spending the night on, and some spooky stuff ends up happening. So you can kind of go into it blind, not understanding how these beings are reaching out to you, or you can take the time to sort of find these hidden clues that sort of delve into the lore a little bit more. So if you'd go that way, I would say it's maybe like 5-ish hours, but you could definitely do, we did a playthrough that was much shorter than that. I would say maybe 3.
Oh, really?
So it's a pretty short game depending on how you play it.
So
but
you could do a single sitting for that.
You definitely could, yeah. Like we played it in one night.
I love to do the single sitting type of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about playing Doki Doki Literature Club.
You should.
I heard that that's a single sitting thing too.
It can be. I would say when I played it, it was about 6 hours to play through it the first-ish time, but we were also kind of taking our time. But yeah, that's another really good one that I would
play
encourage.
That one in the dark with headphones on, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
But yeah, so Oxenfree was really, really interesting, and it's another one that has like teenagers, but their dialogue doesn't feel teenager-y. Like, hey, dude, what's up, bruh?
Yeah.
let's go out to the island. Like,
I played the first probably hour and a half of Oxenfree way back when it first came out, and I was really impressed by the dialogue system. It felt like a more organic kind of next step of a Telltale style.
I've heard that some of the team behind it used to work for Telltale. So that
makes a lot of sense.
I think, yeah, I thought the same thing. And after I played it, I went and sort of did some digging about it. And I totally agree.
Mm. Awesome soundtrack in that game,
yeah,
too.
The whole time we were playing, I was like, I really am into this synthy soundtrack. Like, where is it on my Spotify? and just the mechanic of using, for those who haven't played it, it's these teenagers go out to an island to sort of party, and there's like a rumor that you can hear weird stuff on the radio if you're in a cave out there. And so they mess around on the radio and accidentally like get in touch with an unseen force that starts to sort of torment them.
Big old triangle.
Yep, big old triangle. So the way that they use this radio as a mechanic throughout the game, I thought was really creative, and it was visually really interesting. Like, I thought the art direction in the game was a gorgeous game.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it definitely encourages you. The second time that you play it through, it's very aware that you are playing it through again.
Oh.
And it sort of, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but it's definitely a new game plus that you're going to want to go into a couple of times. Huh. So now that I've played it through twice, I want to try to get a better ending.
It's very like creepypasta-ish.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great description of it. Yes, it totally is like a creepypasta-y.
Yeah, because like some of the, I watched my fiance play through a good chunk of the game because she got really into it. And it got to a point where I was seeing stuff happen on there. I was like, whoa, that's actually like kind of unsettling. Okay,
yeah.
I'm going to leave the room now because I'm probably going to play this game at some point and I don't want to see this stuff.
Yeah, it's very unsettling and very, I don't know, just like tense. Like there are these moments, and especially with the radio, it'll encourage you at certain points to have the radio open to certain stations. Mm. And as you just like go through the different dials, it'll be picking up different noises. And sometimes you're like, oh, is that important? So you'll start listening to it. But really, it's just like creepy noises. So yeah, I loved it. I'm a huge fan of like horror in general. So I was like, ooh.
Are there a lot of, would you say, traditional jump scares in this? Or is
no.
it more just an unsettling, like it's, frightening?
It's more just unsettling, like,
it's
tension?
More like disturbing imagery and implications, I think, right? Well, not even like so much the imagery.
I wouldn't say it's that disturbing. Yeah, I wouldn't say the imagery is disturbing. It's just you're just tense because you wanna get off this island and also solve the mystery. But yeah, it's a great one.
Yeah. I am trucking my way through Persona 5. I am hoping to finish the game before it has been a year since I started playing it. So we're coming right up on that.
One year celebration.
You just passed 100 hours, right?
Yeah. Persona 5 is a game that I have just kind of been chipping away at here and there in between other games. It feels like it's just part of my life now. So I'm gonna be really sad when it ends. But I'm also kind of looking forward to getting to the end of it because it's just such a long game.
Yeah. When it started getting towards the end when I played through it, it's because I wanted to just know what happens with the characters. Like,
yeah,
me too. I fell
I'm
in love
point.
With those characters yeah. and like their whole journey together. And I just wanted to see how it all wrapped up. And as soon as I finished it, I was like, oh, I'm going to miss you guys.
Oh,
I'm going to miss my friends.
Yeah, I think my timer's at like 115 hours, but a lot of that is me kind of like a loading screen pops up and I grab my phone and then I get sucked into Twitter and I'm checking stuff while the game is just sitting there in the background. So realistically, I'm probably closer to like 90 hours or something. I don't know. I'm just guessing, but it's a long game and I'm told that I still have a little ways to go.
Well, a little bit more, yeah.
I mean, I think the sixth palace...
The casino one. I don't remember how many there are, but
yeah,
if you're in the casino
one
you're getting there.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
You're getting
all
there,
right.
Champ.
the thing I'm starting to see that things are kind of coming to a head in the story though, and like things that have been going on for a long time are starting to finally be paid off.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that it seems like I'm kind of winding up for the final act of the game here. It is a long game. I'm complaining about how long it is, but I still just love it so much. It's got some of the best art in any game I've ever played. It's got one of the best soundtracks ever.
Agreed.
It's still super fun. It's got that classic Persona gameplay loop of doing stuff in the real world that affects your ability to fight monsters in the dungeons and vice versa. And yeah, it's really excellent. I realize I'm not going to be able to max out all my confidants by the end of the game, so
yeah.
I'm already kind of loosely planning a second like fast forward playthrough
mm-hmm.
where I can go through in a new game plus and like max out all the confidants and get the platinum trophy and stuff, but we'll see. I said the same thing about Persona 4 Golden and that never happened, so
aww.
We'll see. I was thinking about finding a PlayStation TV, the little doohickey, the little box that we had a while ago that you could plug into the TV and play Vita games on it. I was thinking about hooking one of those up and playing Persona 4 Golden again because that game was great, and I mm-hmm. kind of want to see what it looks like on a giant TV.
Yeah, after playing Persona 5, because I hadn't played anything in the series before and a friend of mine had recommended it to me, having played like 3 onward,
mm-hmm.
I really want to go back and play the other ones. I've heard that Persona 5 is way more accessible and that the other ones can feel like a little bit hard to go back to. But
I have gone back and I tried to play Persona 3 Fez on PS2
mm-hmm.
and I tried to play Persona 3 Portable on my PSP and both, I don't know. I think I was spoiled by P4G when that came out because it's more accessible than P3 is. And I couldn't get into P3. But I hear that it's excellent if you actually get into it and you like get to late game stuff and you finish the game. It's really good. But yeah, I couldn't go back to that after playing Persona 4 Golden.
It's fair.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And P5 is even more accessible.
Sounds like the type of game that I will not have time for.
Yeah, it's a shame. There's lot of games that you should play, but I don't know if you'll have time for a 115-hour game.
Oxenfree, however, sounds like a game that I'll have a little bit of time for.
I definitely think
hopefully.
That's doable.
You been playing any Final Fantasy 14, bud?
Yeah, so still working on Stormblood, and we were talking earlier this morning, and it sounds like I'm almost halfway through the main campaign in Stormblood.
I think you're a little more than halfway.
Yeah, so that I've just been enjoying to pieces.
Yeah.
And
how good is that story, though?
It's great. The cohesion and thematics of Stormblood are excellent.
Yeah.
The writing and localization continues to be, you know, best in class.
The characters are actually super charismatic and really interesting this go around too.
Absolutely. And I think with the upcoming patch, I love in MMOs, as I've said many times before, one of my favorite things about MMOs is the quality of life improvements.
Yeah.
Because you get to see a developer just meticulously refine the things that they're good at over years.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just don't often see that in games unless there's like a live service or, you know, kind of game as service model mm-hmm. to a game. So that's
we're finally getting a glamour book.
Yeah, so that I definitely don't understand how that's all going to work, but I'm very excited. It sounds like it's going to make glamours much easier, and that's basically cosmetic changes.
Final Fantasy XIV players have been asking for this for years. Another big update is they're going to let you stack items up to 999 instead of just 99, which doesn't seem like a huge deal, but if you do crafting and gathering, that is a massive deal. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. So playing that still, I am. I finally picked back up Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yay!
I want to finish it. Holy smokes, I completely forgot everything that I was doing in that game. I had all these active quests, and I was thinking, what was going on here? Revenge of the Nora? What? So I think I'm just chugging along.
I remember when I started picking it back up for Frozen Wilds, I had forgotten like all of the mechanics. Yeah, and I was like, totally. Oh no, what am I doing?
Like, how do I roll? So I can roll and I can sneak, and whistling is still, I say this lovingly, the most overpowered move you can do in that game. You just sit in tall grass and you whistle your way through all the combat scenarios. I love it.
That's not how I played.
Oh, dude, I'll just camp out, or I'll like circle an encampment and just whistle all the enemies out of it and like stealth kill everyone.
You can do that for like watches and stuff, but some of the bigger enemies will give you a hard time with that.
But at like a bandit camp, it's the best way to get rid of them.
It's great.
See, so I do a lot of the rope traps, and I just set them up, and then I'll pick off a few of them with silent headshots, and by the time they see me, they start running toward me, and then they run into the traps.
That's a very tactical strategy. I had a great moment where I spent forever scanning and tagging every bandit in this camp, and then threw a rock to get one of the outliers to come towards me. He was walking towards me, stopped short of my tall grass, so I was going to whistle to have him come even closer, still had the rock equipped, threw the rock at his face, and just alerted the entire camp, and like all my carefully laid plans dissolved. I was both laughing and crying at the same time.
I'm just imagining Aloy like crouching in the grass and just like,
I know, and he's like, what was that noise? So that was not a great move by yours truly, but
nice.
Continues to be gorgeous, mechanically sublime, really interesting lore. I love all the different weapons and different ammo types that you get to play with. The rope caster is really fun. I love tying down big old dinos.
I still got to get in and finish Frozen Wilds. I got about, I think, like halfway through it before I went on break.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Let me ask you this, and I think I've asked this question before, but I kind of need to stoke my memory. There's a lot of hidden lore and narrative-based things in Horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Will I still generally get the crux of the story and the impact of the story if I'm just playing the main campaign mission?
Yes.
Yes. The main quest does a really good job of delving into the essential lore.
Okay.
And then you can sort of add on to that with anything that you pick up that you can read.
Okay. It's more supplemental. And there's some kind of side stories that you'll see if you go and pick up a bunch of collectibles and stuff.
I was going to say, there are definitely some side quests that you can do that, that to me at least seemed a little bit essential, stuff related to like the Shadow Carja.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's stuff that the main quest will take you there, and it makes a lot of sense to have it follow the main quest storyline. I think you'll be fine if you just do the main quest.
Yeah, you'll be all right. Yeah, I mean, it does, especially late game, it just kind of feeds a lot of story to you.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
I played Accounting Plus.
Oh, how was it?
That certainly is a video game.
That is
Holy
a video
cow.
Game.
Holy cow. Not for children.
Oh, boy.
Very much not for children. It is a, that's something.
Yeah. How far would you say you got into it? Or did you finish it completely?
If I finished it. It's like an hour and a half long.
Okay. Did you find any of those hidden levels that I've heard
so
much about?
So I think that the idea is that it's a really short game, but you're meant to play through it a bunch of times and find more stuff as you play through it more times. Mm-hmm. So I played through it once. And I was like, well, that sure was a thing. And then I went on holiday break and, you know, my VR is at home. So I'm probably going to play through it again a couple more times and figure out what the hell is going on with that. It's hilarious, though. I mean, if you have a VR and you're at least 18 years old, you should play it.
We'll report back with a full exclusive summary of all the naughty bits in Accounting Plus.
I mean, it's the guy who did the Stanley Parable and the guy who made Rick and Morty making a VR game. So just, you know,
do the math.
Go ahead and build that expectation that in your head and then multiply it a couple times.
I need to wrap up. Any final parting thoughts?
Black Mirror is awesome.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never watched it before, but I watched the first two episodes of the new season because I was told that you don't have to watch any of it. It's a very good show. I like it a lot.
There is at least a single episode of seasons 1 through 3, which is essentially required viewing for anyone.
Really?
Yes. Hmm. 100%.
Which episode?
San Junipero.
I agree with that.
Okay.
So
it's gorgeous.
Yeah, San Junipero is maybe one of the best episodes in probably the best episodes in the series, and also maybe some of the best like film and / television. Yeah. Wow. Made.
Well, don't tell me anything about it. I'll go home and I'll watch
that's
it tonight.
Yeah,
I think that episode won an Emmy.
Yeah, it's exquisite.
Wow.
Yeah. Like that's at 100%. In fact, I'm almost wondering if you should just cherry pick some other stuff first so you get the full scope of like what's possible and then you watch that one.
Yeah, that's true because it does stand out a little bit from the rest of the show.
It's actually a little better if you watch that after having watched a lot of other episodes of this.
I would maybe, it's in season 3, so I would say maybe just start, because it's not the first episode, I would say just start season 3 to give you context around it.
Yeah.
Because when you watch it, as its own episode within the whole scope of the series, its tone is slightly different. So having the context of other episodes' tones helps, I suppose.
I'll stop watching season 4 for right now. I'll start season 3.
Here's another option. Do you?
First of all, you do you. I would, or you could just finish season 4, enjoy it, and then go back and watch
that's a good point.
San Junipero.
Good point. Solid point from Ryan.
Anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us on the program today. Please send us your questions, your best and favorite new beginnings / openings of video games to blogcast@sony.com. You can find us on PlayStation Blog, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Instagram, all those channels. Subscribe to us in iTunes and leave a review, an honest review. Thank you to Dormy Loon for our theme song. Thank you to Dormy Loon for our theme song, Corey Schmitz for our logo, and we will see you next week. Happy New Year!